Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile and smart speaker. This is the James Gray Show with the Lords Taverners.
You're listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio, on DAB Digital, online or on your Alexa smart speaker. And if you're listening to the podcast, do leave us a rating and a review on iTunes, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Love Sport.
I can't handle the pressure either, because you know what happened to me at 6:30 this morning, I literally woke up worrying about England's creative options. Like, I literally woke up. I don't get up that early because, you know, my show's not till lunchtime. So I usually wake up about 7:30 when the radio comes on. And I woke up stark awake at 6:30, literally worrying about England's attacking options. Going, oh, just, who are we going to play? Harry Kane's so good and can't get him enough. Raheem Sterling's great. It's just so... That's all. Why am I going to... Oh, what's happened to our good midfielders? So if Gareth Southgate thinks he's losing sleep, he should try my bet. No, that's not an offer. I'm not trying to come on to... You know what I mean. Shall I move on? Yeah, maybe I'll move on. Fair enough. I'm getting a very worried look from the box. I also want to talk about Rafael Nadal, who I don't lose sleep over because I always know what I'm getting from Rafael Nadal. The dust, or I suppose the clay, has finally settled on Roland Garros after all the wind at the weekend. Did you see that? Actually blowing up off the court in Nadal's face. It was amazing, really. Frankly, the clay was more likely to beat Nadal than any of his opponents. It'll be a pretty quiet place around there, though, for the next 11 and a half months. But on Sunday, it was anything but. It erupted in that roar that we've heard it 11 times before. And now we've heard it again, a 12th time, because Rafa Nadal is a 12-time French Open champion. No man has ever won that many Grand Slams at one venue. No woman either, by the way, because he went past Margaret Court's 11 Australian Opens. Even when the French Open was only a private club tournament, because before 1921, you had to be a member of Roland Garros to play it. Even then, when it was a small tournament for private members, even then, one man won it 8 times and not 12. Rafa Nadal, frankly, that achievement has surpassed all other sporting achievements for me. In terms of overall dominance in one particular area of a sport, Nadal is the king. So Rafa Nadal at the French Open, I think, is the most dominant, most unbeatable sports person ever. There are others whose achievements you could perhaps compare. Michael Phelps in the 200-metre butterfly. Usain Bolt in the 200 metres running. Michael Schumacher at Manicourt, where he won it 8 times, I think. Or, frankly, any other racetrack. You pick any number. There was a season, by the way, where Schumacher won 12 of the first 13 races. And the only one he didn't win was because Juan Pablo Montoya crashed into the back of him under the safety car. If you don't think that's dominant, I don't know what is. Well, I'll tell you what is. Rafael Nadal at the French Open. Because it spans such a time period. And he's been almost... unparalleled. No one has really played that level of clay court tennis at any point during this period of dominance. He first arrived at Roland Garros for a French Open back in 2005, and he's barely looked back. He's lost just 2 matches. 2! He's only gone out of 3. One of them he didn't even go into. He won his second round match and pulled out before playing Marcel Granollers, so that hardly counts. But only 2 matches. He's actually lost. Novak Djokovic and Robin Soderling, a man whose career was sadly cut short by glandular fever. They're the only 2 men ever to have beaten Rafa Nadal at Roland Garros. Just think about that. It's 15 years of winning tennis matches. 93 tennis matches he's won at Roland Garros. This fortnight in particular was, I think, some of the best tennis I've ever seen Nadal play. I've seen him play a fair bit. I've seen him in the flesh. I've never seen him in the flesh on clay. I've seen him on grass. I've seen him on hard court, indoor, outdoor. But though some of those performances were right up there with the very best of Nadal, which says a lot because it's an extremely high bar. He's now an 18-time Grand Slam champion. It's not as though he's short of comparisons. And, you know, this is a guy at the age of 33 in what's supposed to be a young man's sport, playing as well as he's ever played. And being the most dominant sports person we've ever really seen in any particular form of any game, I think. He played Federer like just a couple of days ago. He limited him to 9 games. This isn't just some bloke who's turned up to play the second round. This is Roger Federer, 20-time Grand Slam champion, and he only got 9 games off it. Okay, Nadal dropped a set to Goffin, but when the match was basically over anyway, at 2 sets to love. The only person who actually levelled a match in sets with him was Dominic Thiem, who pulled back the second set. But even that was a mistake, because Nadal was just angered and then proceeded to win 12 of the next 14 games because Dominic Thiem had poked the bear. Part of Nadal's dominance long-term, though, must partly come from Federer. You know, we mentioned that he swept him aside with such ease the other day. But part of it must come from having Federer push him. He's always known that Grand Slams on other surfaces are going to have Roger Federer standing in his way. Even the French Open did for a lot of it. So he's had that pressure, that added pressure of knowing, if I want to catch Federer, and we know this is something he's talked about, if I want to catch Federer in the Grand Slam stakes, I've got to win the French Open every year. That is the minimum I have to do. He tried to claim on Sunday that if, and this is a quote, at the end of my career, I'm able to win a couple of more Grand Slams and be closer to Roger, it'll be unbelievable. If not for me, still unbelievable, no? Sort of trying to shrug it off and say, look, I've won 18 Grand Slams. I've still had a blooming good career. And he has. But it does make a difference that he hasn't caught Federer. Of course it does. It's what's kept him going all these years. And it's kind of what's made this French Open achievement quite so remarkable. He hasn't been short of competition. Djokovic is an excellent clay court player. Federer is an excellent clay court player, even if it's not his best surface. These 12 titles, even Federer can't catch. He's got 8 Wimbledon titles. He's going to be 41 by the time he could, in theory, equal Nadal's record of 12 at the same Grand Slam. And that's why, for me, Nadal's record stands alone. No other sports person has been as dominant in one particular area.
Love Sport.
Now, I'm sure I don't need to tell you that the Ligue 1 transfer window is officially open. Well, not as of now, but as of today, it is open. French clubs can start their moving and shaking for the summer, and we expect it to be a big one for Paris Saint-Germain. PSG being linked, particularly today, with Matisse de Ligt. Of course, he is being also linked with Barcelona, with Manchester United, but PSG appear to have the biggest financial package, if you'll pardon the expression. Let's speak to someone who might be able to tell us exactly how big that package is. Robin Berner is on the line, French football expert. Robin, we understand PSG are leading the race for De Ligt. Is that accurate? And if so, what does that actually mean?
Yeah, they certainly are. Obviously, Manchester United seem to have stolen in early March, but PSG have really come back and made him one of their big transfer priorities of the summer. They want to really renovate their squad over the summer. Obviously, we saw them struggle in the Champions League. They had a poor end to the season in Ligue 1. So they're going to make a big financial effort to improve their squad, not only for next season, but for seasons forward in front of that. And obviously, De Ligt's one of the brightest young defenders in Europe at the moment. And they're really doing everything they can to get him at Parc des Princes next season.
Is it quite as simple as we're going to give him the most wages? Does it just come down to that?
No, I don't think it does. Obviously, players now are looking at, first and foremost of playing at teams that are in the Champions League. PSG really feel that they need to be contenders to win the Champions League. And at the moment, they are needing to throw money at players to try and persuade them to play for PSG. Obviously, with the likes of Barcelona and Manchester United, there's a little more historical prestige with these clubs, so they perhaps don't need the same financial backing to get similar players. So, and I think that's why you see PSG throwing such big wages at players.
The other one they might be tempted to throw big wages at is David De Gea. We understand from yesterday that United are willing to give him a sort of £20 million golden goodbye as long as he agrees to go quickly and quietly this summer. I was slightly surprised to see, even with Buffon leaving, De Gea link, because obviously they've got Kevin Trapp. Now, I know he's been away on loan, but will he not come back and expect to play at PSG, or is this likely that he'll move on this summer as well?
I think we'll see him move on. PSG have given several different goalkeepers the opportunity, Buffon among them, and none of them have really been able to hold down a first-team spot. You know, perhaps their best goalkeeper is actually Alphonse Areola, but they've kind of mucked him about, to be honest. by bringing in Buffon. Buffon was meant to sort of elevate Areola's game, but instead he just kind of shared the first team responsibilities with him, and as a result, perhaps didn't improve to the standard that might have been expected of him. He actually had some very good games last season, and his rhythm was almost interrupted by Buffon coming in, which I think was one of the major downsides of Buffon, apart from his own performance. So that's why PSG are in the market for a goalkeeper. They're just simply looking for somebody who can be reliable for them, and they've just not had that for several seasons now.
They're supposed to be leading the race for De Ligt, as we said. Are they leading the race for De Gea as well, do you think?
I think there's a strong possibility. Obviously, they've been linked with De Gea for several seasons now. You know, having Leonardo back as their sporting director, as the man to sort of spearhead their transfer campaign, he's a very capable mover and shaker in that sort of market. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if they were also leading the race to sign De Gea.
Let's talk a little bit about France in general, because I was sort of drawn to a result over the weekend, which is France losing to Turkey. Now, I don't think I've had much interest in the Turkish national side for about 20 years. The world champions losing to them piqued my interest. What on earth is going on? I know they were beaten by the Netherlands as well. The world champions stuttering a bit?
Yeah, and I'm not... Obviously, going to Turkey is not the easiest game. I'm sure most people would admit that, but at the same time, you would expect the world champions to win that match. France are a team that have kind of struggled a little bit in terms of qualification. They've never really qualified convincingly for many tournaments. We saw them struggle against Belarus in each of the last couple of campaigns. So for them to go and lose at Turkey isn't necessarily the biggest shock. I think what was the biggest issue was the performance. They obviously didn't manage a single shot on target over the course of the whole match. They were utterly outplayed in every department. Key players just looked disinterested and not very energetic. I think it was basically the performance rather than the result itself that was the biggest shock in France. And they were certainly going to be looking for a reaction when they play Andorra.
Well, I mean, when it comes to games you really want next on the fixture list to give a reaction, Andorra feels like one of them, frankly. Although, I don't know, maybe it's a lose-lose, because if they win 8-0, you know, you go, well, yeah, you should be Andorra 8-0. They've only got one professional footballer.
Well, yeah, perhaps. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a match they should win, and I'm sure they will win quite comfortably.
So there's no suggestion that this is a little bit of the wheels haven't come off for France. This is just a blip more than anything more serious.
I would suggest just now, after just one result, it's a blip. If it continues, then perhaps you can start to ask more significant questions. Obviously, a lot of these players are coming off the back of a long season. It was a very poor performance, as I said. So for the moment, it's a blip. If it continues and it becomes a trend, then yes, it's certainly something more serious. But I would be surprised if that was to be the case.
Just finally, I feel I have to ask about Paul Pogba, because there are, as there are almost every summer, or even more often than that, stories about him leaving Manchester United. We're going to get another Pogback, I read today. Juve saying they'll have to sell 5 players to get him. Do you think that's got any legs whatsoever? Does Pogba still have that real affinity with Juventus?
Yeah, there's no doubt that Pogba's got a massive affinity with Juventus. It's obviously where he's played his best senior football on a consistent basis. As a professional, so you know, he loves Juve. Juve love him. He's got the sort of love there that he doesn't yet command at Manchester United. Whether they can afford to get him back, I mean, obviously they're talking about selling 5 players, which is a huge investment to get a player like Pogba back. I'm not sure, frankly. And I can see him staying at Manchester United simply because of his superstar draw. They're going to want to find more from him, obviously.
Is there a feeling in France that they want Pogba to leave or stay? Because presumably the French football public want him to succeed at club level as much as they do at international level.
Yeah, that's a fair point, actually. It's difficult to say. I mean, I would say they obviously want him to succeed. I think they would want him to succeed on the highest level possible and at the biggest club possible, and obviously there's not too many bigger clubs than Manchester United, so I think there's probably a feeling in France that they want him to succeed there, but you know, it's obviously on the edge of a knife to some extent at the moment.
Robin, thank you so much for your expertise as always. I'm sure we'll talk over summer. Sounds like there's going to be lots of transfer lines flooding in and out of France. And as I say, the Ligue 1 transfer window officially opened today. And that's Robin Berner giving us the benefit of his experiences. He's a French football expert, of course.
Love Sport.
Now, they're all big summers for Manchester United, but we think this one might be particularly big because they cannot afford to slide any further down the table. It's Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's first as manager as well. It'll be fascinating to see who might come in. We already think Daniel James is all but done to move from Swansea, but who might follow him? Will it be Harry Maguire? I'm sure our next guest has a view on it. We've got Gordon Hill, the former United winger, on the line. Gordon, we see these links between United and Maguire. Do you think he's the type of player they desperately need in defence?
Well, really looking at it, you had Jones and Smalley coming out of the same type of mould, and they've struggled. But when you come from, say, somewhere like Leicester, and you come to somewhere like United, you're going to have to be on top draw. You've got to be able to, like, step in there. Now, yes, he's had a good season and everything else, but I think you've got to really look at what do they want for him, how much they want to spend on him, what can he do for you, and how he can actually push the actual club and position. So if you're looking at a fresh face, yes, I would say yes, he would be definitely one that you've got to mark in. But it all, again, depends upon the price and what they want. We've seen the young boy James come in, and he's going to have to be nurtured and pushed into it. So it's an interesting scenario that Ollie's got. And with so many players being bandied around and the price tags that players have got nowadays, it's a case of saying, well, are you buying the player because he's the top quality, or are you buying the player because they put an expensive price tag on him and they want to get rid of him?
Do you think clubs also see United coming a little bit, and they put an extra 10 mil on just because it's United?
Yeah. Yes, they've done that. They've done that since the turn of time for me. You know, even when you go to, you know, when you go in there, you go for a player that's, say, 5 million. And all of a sudden, like, his price tag steps up to 20 million because it's Man U. You know, you're not dealt the same playing field if you're being sold to Man United, for argument's sake, you're going to be paying through the nose as a United personnel for that player that may have either gone to, say, someone like Leicester, which is no disrespect to them, would be about 5 million. You're having to pay 25 million. And now you're looking to say, am I getting quality out of that player? I think the scenario's come now where price tags have gone up so much that players now that you're looking at are now looking at saying, well, OK, are they coming to United just for the sake of United or want to play for United, or are they coming because there's an expensive price tag put on their heads, and it's just been escalating and escalating. And so, you know, are we getting a player that's going to be a United player, or are we going to get a player with a price tag?
Do you think as a former United player yourself, is it a shame to see that United are having to go and cherry-pick youth and talent from elsewhere as opposed to doing what they always used to do, which is produce talent through their own ranks?
Well, I think, to be honest with you, I think they've been warned. I mean, you know, from players beforehand, the way that the United structure has always been, we've always been a developing club. We develop players. We develop players right the way through. Sparky, Giggsy, and right the way through the system. I was one of those. One that was a rare buy, but it wasn't. It was expensive, but wasn't expensive. You look at Stevie Coppell to come through. You look at Brian Greenhoff to come through the system. You know, everybody's looking for that golden ticket again, which Fergie had, of six or seven of their young players going into the first team and not costing them a lot of money. And then all of a sudden, helping it out, say, with like Schmeichels and the Roy Keanes, and bringing those players in to stabilise it. Eric Cantona came in, but they still had that nucleus of six or seven players. We haven't got those six or seven players in the youth team at this moment in time that we could actually put in. We've seen flashes of a couple of them during the season. But if you're going to go that way, you're going to have to get rid of... You're going to have to get rid of all your boys that have got the top wages and the top earners. And then what you've got to do with those top earners, you've got to replace it with the desire that wants to play for Man United. You have to bring that back in to the fold, not just because they're getting, you know, 250-300 grand. I mean, when does it stop? You know, when all of a sudden do you say, hold on a minute, we can't keep on paying that? And I think it's reached that with us not being the top club in terms of being able to buy those top people. You've got a club across the road, Man City, that are doing it. You know, they're buying a lot. You know, all of a sudden you've got PSG, you've got Real Madrid that just bought Hazard. I mean, it seems that they're just going now. It's instant success. And unfortunately, we weren't in that instant success because we fell out of that. But we've either got to say to ourselves, right, are we going to go instant success and just throw money at it and possibly not get it? Or are we going to start developing? With Ollie, I would say, yes, Ollie, go and get all the young players that you can look at and have got potential and show them and put them into a unit, because that's exactly what I do here in the States. I get players that want to play, want to show you, and put them into it. And I think that doesn't change from when Fergie had the six fledglings.
Just sorry. When it comes to bringing young players into that environment, I worry, you know, if you're a young player and you're not, you know, obviously if United come calling, you're almost always going to say yes. There's still that sort of name. But how do you ensure that as a young player introduced into the team, it works? You know, as a manager, what do you do to make sure that they succeed and they don't flounder?
That's a $64 million question. That's a $62 million question that you're asking. Do you bring in an established manager to just go around and buy, like Mourinho? Buy, bring them in, don't work, bye-bye, card in, leave, away you go. Or do you get somebody in to say, okay, the structure of the club has got to be in such a way that you've got to start developing. Everything that you have in the academy at United should be looking towards the first team. And you've got to be able to put all your emphasis on that youth under 19, under 20 players that could show potential and make potential and push for potential. That's where your developing has got to be with your young players. Your young players will not be able to develop if you haven't got that in the first place, because you've just said it. They're going to go into the... You have a worry about that. Well, if you're worried about it, you're never going to get there. You're never even going to give them a chance to produce it and say, yes, these kids can do it. You know, we've got to believe in a new generation to be able to do what we're doing. That's what I do. I believe in that generation. I believe in the player showing it, you know. And I think, you know, somehow we've got to keep with the big boys. Totally agree. I totally agree with everybody. You know, you've got to spend on a bit of quality. But does the quality come because they're paying money as opposed to just wanting to come?
Just very finally, Gordon, and quickly, do you think United will be back in the Champions League next season?
Champions League, well, I mean, they possibly could be, but, you know, you're relying on other people to do your job for you, and that's what scares me. You've got to be able to take care of your own business first. Get your own house in order before you start looking at other clubs, and then start chatting. Ajax is a prime example. Dead for a few years where you really didn't see them, and now all of a sudden they've got players all over the place. that would be nice to be able to see. And I think United have got all the tools to be able to produce it. It's how they produce it now. It's entirely up to them.
Gordon, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're a busy man. It's always a pleasure to speak to you. Gordon Hill there, Manchester United winger. And yes, it's a massive summer for them, and how they go about their business will define what happens next year.
Love Sport.
And yeah, just to reiterate that unbelievable news coming out of the Love Island Villa, that Sharif Lanre has been kicked off the show just 9 days in. I can't believe it. Honestly, I'm really struggling to react to this, Ben. Can I move on? Can I talk about boxing? Great, excellent. My producer Ben's a big Love Island fan, and everyone else appears to be a really big Love Island fan, but I just can't get behind it, I'm afraid. Sharif, if you're listening, it's all right, mate. Your life will go on, and frankly, probably get better. So we've lost one contestant from the Love Island Villa because he broke the rules. We've lost one British heavyweight champion too in the last week or 10 days. But fortunately, we've still got Tyson Fury, or as he's now better known, Tommy's brother, who Tyson still claims that he is a heavyweight champion. I'm the lineal heavyweight champion of the world. I'm a fighting man. And if you want to be champion of the boxing, you've got to beat me. Well, he's a self-titled heavyweight champion of the world these days. I don't think he is, but he's the closest thing that we've got in Britain since Joshua was upset by Andy Ruiz Jr. So we find ourselves in a sort of, well, a weird situation where we have to listen to him because while he isn't the champion, he is a champion of sorts. I'm not necessarily convinced that he should be, but what he says does travel far and wide, and whatever you think about him, he is entertaining. Nevertheless, the defeat... Look, he should be glad that Anthony Joshua has lost Tyson Fury. And it's a myth that Joshua is easy to beat. You just whack him on the side of the head and he can't recover. That is boxing, to be fair. Whack someone on the side of the head so hard that they can't recover. But Joshua's defeat might actually have opened a new route back to a world title for the Gypsy King. Because Ruiz is now likely, in fact almost certain, to be handed a mandatory challenger by the WBO in the next couple of weeks. He will have to refuse it, because he'll have to take the rematch of Joshua instead. It's a much more lucrative fight for him anyway. So that means they'll strip him of the title. Ruiz will still be a world champion, because he'll be WBA and IBF world champion. But he won't have the WBO belt anymore, and they will instead order a vacant title fight. Now, if you look at the rankings, assuming Tyson Fury beats Tom Schwartz at the weekend in Las Vegas, and we all expect him to, Fury will become second in the rankings, the challenger rankings. First is Dillian Whyte. So it's not inconceivable that the WBO could end up ordering a fight for the world heavyweight title between Tyson Fury and Dillian Whyte, which will sell out any stadium you like in the UK three times over. They'll have it at Wembley. I don't know. Well, they'll probably have it at Millennium Stadium, actually. End of the year, probably? The weekend before the Joshua Ruiz rematch? Maybe the weekend after, with Joshua ringside having gained his belts back to sell a Joshua versus the winner fight? This is great for boxing, by the way. I know it's all ifs and buts, but that's kind of what the heavyweight division is like at the moment. And don't say it's not exciting, because the prospect of Joshua winning back two belts and then walking down to Cardiff, maybe where he's just fought the week before, and saying, would you like to fight for all three belts to either Dillian Whyte or Tyson Fury? That is a very intriguing prospect indeed. Now, boxers dodge each other, and they've done it a lot in the heavyweight division. I'm hoping that freeing up some of these belts will stop them being able to dodge each other, and we'll get proper fights. And actually, to be honest, Fury's as guilty of it as anyone. If he were actually the fighting man that he's always said he was, if he really was a fighting man like he says he is, then he would say to Joshua, "Fight! I'll fight you anyway. I don't need the belts. This is about me proving I'm a better fighter." If he's that much better than him, as he always says he is, why not just do it? Why not just tap him around for 12 rounds, take the unanimous decision and walk off with goodness knows how many million pounds? This is the problem in heavyweight boxing. Just take the fights. I don't want to hear two men both say they can beat each other and never fight. It might happen. Imagine if that Fury-Wilder fight was the only one we got between these three. Between these three legends of this current era of heavyweight boxing. And all we got was one fight that ended in what everyone says was a pretty unsatisfactory draw. In all this talking, at least, there has been some decent advice from Tyson Fury, and something that I've said a couple of times actually on this show, which is that Joshua needs to get rid of the arse kisses. Fury said in an interview with The Telegraph, he needs to get shot of every arse kisser around him, because in this game there's no space for yes men, no pats on the back, no bag men. Now, I think it's pretty ironic coming from Tyson Fury, who has often surrounded himself with yes men. I would suggest, and when there were fallouts, has been happy to get rid of people. But he is right, even if he doesn't follow his own advice. He said, like Joshua's dad, he needs to get a bit smarter and listen to people who care, not people who are around him for a free ride. The invincibility factor is gone. Now, the invincibility thing we can move on from, but it is worth saying that when you're a boxer, you do need people around you who are in it for your best interests. And who also understand your attitude to the sport. Because some boxers want to go out and take big fights. And you can't always let them, because sometimes you have to build things a different way. But also, if there's a boxer out there who just wants to fight, and he says, you know what, I want to take the big fights, then let him. because that's what fans love. They love someone who's prepared to get in the ring. Look at Dave Allen, right? Not a very talented heavyweight. A decent fighter, but he's never going to win a world title. But he takes every fight that's offered to him. And fans love him for that. And he has made the most out of what talent he has because of that. Sure, he might not be the most committed, but he's a fun guy and he's someone who takes big fights. If his attitude were replicated in some of the even bigger fighters, then we might have a serious heavyweight division on our hands.
Love Sport.
And we're now going to speak to Carlo Garganese, global head of features for Goal and Italian Football Expert. And the reason is Chelsea have already, we understand, begun talks to replace Maurizio Sarri because he will be announced, or at least the club believe he'll be announced as Juventus manager within the next 48 hours. The shortlist is being put together. A few managers are even being so bold as to throw their names into that. But let's find out why Maurizio Sarri's gone. What's going to happen? How will he be received in Italy? Carlo is on the line now. Carlo, why don't you just tell us a little bit about Maurizio Sarri's reputation in Italy? He obviously managed there for a long time and was pretty successful to a certain extent with Napoli.
Hi, James. Yeah, well, until Sarri, you know, joined Chelsea last year, his reputation in Italy was someone who played, you know, really great football, very unique kind of Pep Guardiola-esque style of football, but somebody who ultimately, you know, had never won anything. So he, for that reason, there was always, you know, a bit of a question mark whether he could really make it a very, very top club, you know, almost, you know, in the bracket of Juventus, but also in the bracket of Chelsea. So there was always that question mark because Napoli was the biggest team that he'd managed. Before that, he was at Empoli. And then, you know, most of his career was at lower league clubs, really. So, you know, now he's, despite all the up and down season that he had with Chelsea, he won the Europa League. So he now has a sort of a major title. To his name. So we'll have to see really whether you know that will win over some Juventus fans.
Do you think his switch, you know, to England, cause as you say, he had a long career in Italy, and you know, coming to the Premier League is a very different thing. Was it one of those things? Well, I've got to prove myself somehow, and the obvious way to do that is in England, and maybe there's an element of that by going to Juventus now as well, to prove something to people?
Possibly. I mean, I think one thing that you have to remember is that until Sarri joined Chelsea, he never really had a team that were kind of expected to win trophies. I mean, what he did at Napoli was almost a miracle in almost winning the title with Napoli. I mean, he set a points record. With Napoli, I think it was 91 points he got, which was absolutely incredible. So those that used to complain about Sarri during his time at Chelsea and say, oh, he's never won anything. Well, until he joined Chelsea, he never really had a chance to win anything. If he'd have won anything with Napoli, it would have been a miracle.
He'll certainly have a chance to win things at Juve, which begs the question, why Max Allegri walked away in the first place? You know, you're all but guaranteed the league title. He still had something to prove in the Champions League. Why do you think he really left?
Well, he'd been there for 5 years. He'd won the title every single year. The problem is that winning the league title is not enough now for Juventus. You know, a bit like PSG in France or even with Bayern Munich in Germany, the way that European football has gone in a lot of these leagues is that it's a formality winning your league championship. It's all about the Champions League now. And the Champions League is Juventus' obsession. They haven't won it since 1996. They signed Ronaldo in a crazy deal to win them the Champions League. And the last 2 years, haven't really been anywhere close to challenging for the Champions League. So I think Allegri has, you know, done a great job, but the last 2 years things went stale, and I think it was time for a change. And ultimately, I think that's why he's left.
So do you think when it's the mutual consent, it might actually have been mutual consent for once?
I think so. Yeah, I think in this case it probably was mutual consent. Yeah, I think Allegri was really getting a hammering from fans this season, and I think he probably realised deep down that
you know, maybe it was time for him to leave as well. He'd done as much as he could, really, with Juventus.
Will Sarri bring Jorginho with him, do you think? Is that going to be his sort of moniker now, where wherever he goes, Jorginho follows? Or have Juventus already got a player who can do that job for him?
I'm sure he'd love to bring him with him, but I think realistically it's very unlikely, because Chelsea, with the transfer ban, it's, you know, if they can't sell Jorginho if they're not going to be able to sign a replacement. So I don't see Chelsea allowing that to happen. As for Juventus, they already do have a player that can play that role in Miralem Pjanic. You know, he is someone that's, I would say, is not unsellable. If a big offer came in and they could replace him with Jorginho, I think that's definitely something they would potentially consider. But like I said, because of from the Chelsea angle, I just don't see it being a possibility with the transfer ban.
How do you think, you mentioned, you know, Sarri's reputation in Italy, not necessarily won anything. Do you think he will go down well as a replacement with Juventus fans?
Perhaps not initially. I think at the moment, Juventus fans are probably lukewarm at best to the idea of Sarri taking over. I think a lot of them remember a title game last year where he flipped the bird. He stuck his middle finger up at Juventus fans before a big game in Turin, on the team bus. So a lot of fans are kind of angry with him that. He's Neapolitan, born in Naples, and Neapolitans hate Juventus. They're like the devil to them. So he's got that to overcome. But, you know, the same thing happened to Allegri when he took over. There were massive protests on the day that he arrived in Turin, you know. Nobody wanted Allegri. Everyone thought he was totally the wrong choice, and he soon kind of won over the fans. So, you know, it's just the way it is a lot of the time in Italy. They're very passionate fans. And if you get results in the field, I'm sure he'll win them over.
And just finally, Carlo, of course, the Cristiano Ronaldo, Maurizio Sarri clash. Do you think they'll get on all right?
Well, I think Ronaldo last season was frustrated at times with the style of football, as were all Juventus fans, that Allegri played, kind of very kind of conservative, defensive, counter-attacking football that isn't really, doesn't win you Champions League titles. Now, I'm not, you know, I know as well as anyone that Sarri has his flaws, but I think at least he has a style of play that is offensive, you know, something that would be more to Ronaldo's liking. I remember one game last season where Ronaldo was, you know, he was begging his teammates to push up the field, to press towards the halfway line, to stop sitting back. And, you know, that will, with Sarri, they will at least kind of press, push up high and trying to, you know, take the game to the opposition, dominate possession. So from that side of it, I think that is a positive for Ronaldo. But we'll have to wait and see.
Well, I'm sure he'll find a way to fall out with Maurizio Sarri. They don't seem like they're going to acquiesce exactly. Carlo, thank you so much for joining us. Always a pleasure to have an expert voice on these things. Carlo Garganese there, the global head of features for Goal and an Italian football expert in his own right as well. Maurizio Sarri and Cristiano Ronaldo. I somehow don't think they'll be spending Christmas together.
Love sport.
And I've been talking a lot about transfers, and it's inevitable at this time of year that we do talk a lot about which players might be making moves. It kind of keeps the whole football windmill whirling round, doesn't it? But Manchester United are one of those teams who usually dominate headlines in transfers, and I don't think they're going to in the same way this year, because why would any self-respecting young British footballer go and play for Manchester United at the moment? Seriously, well, what would be the point in them going to United and playing? Harry Maguire was one of the few English successes in Portugal last week. The fangs sang his name to that tune, you know, La Bamba, but it doesn't really work. It's got some of the worst scansion of any football chant I've ever heard. It's horrible. He took a super cool penalty, and crucially, and this is important, he wasn't John Stones. The price tag on Maguire is, of course, massive. And look, if you've got a problem with it, fine, but just accept it. That's kind of the market in football now, and we just need to move on. But it's unsurprising that Maguire is a United target. He ticks all the boxes. They need a centre-half. They need a ball-playing one. He's very confident with the football at his feet. And if they want to play the football that the fans expect, they need him to do that. So, oh, and by the way, Matthias de Ligt is going to cost them an absolute fortune in transfers and wages because PSG have joined the race for him. But Maguire doesn't have to join United. Once upon a time, he would have had to. Well, you know, when they come calling, you say yes. Aaron Wan-Bissaka too. United have had a bid of £40 million rejected by Palace for him. If that's not a wake-up call to the United board and their fans, I don't know what is. Because there was a time, not long ago, when that bid and the news of that bid would have triggered a chain of events that began with Wan-Bissaka ringing his agent, had a transfer request in the middle of it, and ended with a Palace manager doing a press conference that said, it was United, how are you supposed to stop him? You know, we couldn't not let him go. But Wan-Bissaka doesn't have to join United. Neither of these players should. Why would they? Why would you want to go to a club who rattled through four or five different managers, and very different managers as well, who have routinely failed to sign regulation top talent in the right way? They've lost their commitment to promoting youth and developing young players, whose manager is essentially a legendary club striker who doesn't upset the players or the dressing room. There are no reasons that I can honestly support, positive reasons for a player to go there. And are they signing the right types of players? Are they going after? They can't be, because as a good player, you wouldn't do it. And we spoke to Gordon Hill a little earlier, the former United winger. Just have a listen what he had to say.
If you're going to go that way, you're going to have to get rid of. You're going to have to get rid of all your boys that have got the top wages and the top earners. And then what you've got to do with those top earners, you've got to replace it with the desire that wants to play for Man United. You have to bring that back in to the fold, not just because they're getting, you know, 250, 300 grand. I mean, when does it stop? You know, when all of a sudden do you say, hold on a minute, we can't keep on paying that? And I think it's reached that with us not being the top club in terms of being able to buy those top people. You've got a club across the road, Man City, that are doing it. You know, they're buying a lot. You know, all of a sudden you've got PSG, you've got Real Madrid that just bought Hazard. I mean, it seems that they're just going now. It's instant success. And unfortunately, we weren't in that instant success because we fell out of that. But we've either got to say to ourselves, right, are we going to go instant success and just throw money at it and possibly not get it? Or are we going to start developing?
Gordon Hill there. And I kind of agree with him to a certain extent. If you're a Harry Maguire and Aaron Wan-Bissaka, you don't have to go to United because there are other clubs which will be more successful, interested in your services. We understand City are interested in both Maguire and Wan-Bissaka. Now, why would you go to Europa League United over Champions League City when the gulf between those two clubs is absolutely enormous? And in some ways, why would United want them? And I think that's what Gordon was trying to say, is that if you've got a player who wants to be playing Champions League football right away, don't sign them at United, because they're not going to be doing it. Don't pull them in. So that's kind of why the Daniel James transfer makes sense. He's a young lad. He's been playing Championship football. He can't reasonably expect to jump straight into a Champions League first team. He couldn't. But it also suggests that United are not ready to go straight back to the top. United realised that this problem took a long time to create, because they've been stuck in the doldrums for months and even years, and this problem would also take a long time to fix. They're two or three seasons away from being a top four side again. So that's why they're signing players for £15-20 million. That's why they're bidding £40 million for a guy who's much more like 60. And that's why Harry Maguire and Aaron Wan-Bissaka are going to find it relatively easy to turn down Manchester United this summer.
Love sport.
We're going to talk a little bit of England now, because it's not been a great week for them at the Nations League. Beaten 3-1 by the Netherlands. And then I thought, frankly, didn't play brilliantly against Switzerland either. JJ Bull is on the line, a writer for Telegraph, football writer, a tactista as well, a man who knows football tactics inside out. JJ, I want to sort of put to you this Chris Waddle piece, which you may or may not have seen, but essentially he says that England do need to stick to possession football, but they do need a plan B and they currently don't have one. Does that make some sense?
Yeah, I mean, Chris Waddle would know what he's talking about. He's quite good at football.
He's played a bit.
Yeah. But, I mean, of course they have a plan B. The point is that Southgate's trying to introduce this whole playing out from the back thing, because it means you keep possession so you can turn an attack from an opposition team into your own attack and potentially score. without just hoofing it and chasing the ball, which is what England have done forever. It takes a long time to make it work, and you need generations of younger players to come through who are well versed in it. Like, you saw how Holland can just do it all over the place. Every single player is fluent in that language, but England players aren't. And you tend to see, if you go and watch any Sunday league game, people just hauk it down the wing and chase it. But if you're abroad and you watch other teams, they don't do that.
what was that particular verb there, JJ? Hauk, is it?
Hauking, yes.
Right, it's clearly a very Scottish term for football.
That's what they teach us at school, yeah.
Well, didn't they invented passing football in Scotland, didn't they? It's a shame they've forgotten about it, really. But look, do you see anyone in this current crop of England players who is, and we've used this word a lot lately, technical enough, and I suppose basically talented enough in terms of passing the ball to fulfil a role in midfield that will allow them to play out from the back more effectively?
Yeah, Harry Winks, he can do it, and he does it for Spurs. He's the exact kind of player that you need. And you look at Michael Carrick, never really got, I think, utilised properly when he was in the England team. Neither did Paul Scholes. Exactly the same kind of players that England need now, who, before they receive the ball, have already scanned, know where everyone is, take one touch, it's always perfect, and they can play it off. You get Winks now. Players coming through, you get people like Phil Foden, who you see him do it for Man City. He's not quite there yet. James Maddison, I think, has a lot to do with working off the ball before he's able to do that in a deeper midfield role. He still likes to be a 10, like most young creative attacking players do. Mm. But other than that, I'm sure there are other players. Like Lewis Cook's another one at Bournemouth, but he's been injured for the last little while. He's very good at just tip-tapping it around. It's not very exciting. It's the kind of thing that Tom Cleverley used to get absolutely battered for. But when you have players in that midfield who understand the space and when to go and how to link a pass, like the thing I see with England players when they get the ball. So Barkley gets the ball, turns and goes forward. That's good. That's quite direct. But what you're trying to do with the Southgate style is build it. So what you should be doing is passing and then moving. But what England players do is receive the ball, pass it, and then stand. And then that, you see like John Stones gets caught in the ball because he's used to players at Man City moving straight away after receiving the ball because they know they have to be in a slightly more vertical position. So there's triangles created. And too often England are quite flat and that's where they get caught out.
Do you think that we lack an attitude overall in football in this country? Because you take, for example, Jorginho, who is supposed to be the king of this, and he's been booed from pillar to post at Chelsea because he's not very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, there's extremes. There's no right or wrong way to do it. I say Jorginho, I mean, he doesn't offer anything going forward. You've got, for example, in his same position, you could put Frankie de Jong, who would drop deep, do the things that Jorginho's meant to do, but also drives forward and links the play. He's far more dynamic. And you've got players like Sergio Busquets, who does the same sort of thing for Barcelona, has done for years. You could even look at, I mean, there are loads and loads of examples I could name, but I can't think off the top of my head right this very second. But England don't have many of those. I don't know if it's an attitude problem per se with all the players. I mean, there's good players there, right? They're very fast. They're very good in the ball. Jadon Sancho is a great example of like a very clever player, really quick, great feet. But then you want to combine that with what England have been good at historically, which has been strong and just getting stuck into players, not making it easy for them. But that's where you always lack these midfielders. And it could be that they're getting lost in generations below where, when they're coming through the academies. These sort of smaller players, players who would look like Iniesta, haven't got into the first team. But I think that is starting to change and you see it in the likes of Phil Foden coming through now at City.
Do you see any of it in Jordan Henderson? Do you think he's the kind of player who can offer something like that? Because, look, I'm one-eyed on this because I'm a Liverpool fan. I think he's massively underrated, but I don't know if you feel the same way.
He's a weird one, right? So I think he's a good player. I don't think he'd be able to play for Real Madrid or Barcelona. And that's the kind of standard you want when you're looking at your midfielders. They should be getting poached at some point. Mm. Jordan Henderson has like captain's determination, drive, leadership qualities. You want him on the pitch because you make people around him better, and you want those kind of players in your team because they do all the hard work. It inspires others to work harder. But I think the classic example of where Jordan Henderson's limit is at is when you look at the World Cup semi-final against Croatia. Modric and Rakitic, this high pressure game, both feet perfect, always turning, moving, passing, everything perfect, really, really made a mistake, confident, able to bring the ball forward and take on players. They don't change the way they play. Jordan Henderson, however, was just launching it, trying to do a captain Braveheart Gerrard, pinging it 70 yards to try and take the team forward, when what you need is these hammerheads who just are confident in possession and they're not scared that their dad's going to be shouting, "Get rid!" every time they get the ball.
It sounds like your father's got a very specific attitude to football.
Oh, no, he was fine. He was good. That's
it. All right, I'll take your word for it. I'm not going to say you're optimistic because I know you're a proud Scot and would never support England in any sort of situation.
No, my parents are English.
Oh, okay, fine. Okay, good. Yeah, that's not a problem. Are you optimistic that England will go into Euro 2020 still playing this style of football and with a midfield that can do it?
Well, what I would imagine will happen in Euro 2020 is that England will qualify off the back of a fairly easy qualification group, go in with sort of middling expectations, which quickly become very optimistic expectations around about game one or two after beating, they beat Scotland 1-0 or 2-0, right? Yeah. And then everyone goes, wow, this is it. It's coming home, lads. It's coming home. And then they get through into the knockout rounds. They scrape through the first one and then they get knocked out. Because in high-pressure games, those players don't have it quite in them to go that extra yard. Look at Liverpool and Spurs in the Champions League final. Was it one English player started? Mm. It's not that English players are great. It's that the players around them in the clubs are very good, which should hopefully bleed down into the younger players coming through in generations. The under-17s and the 19s, 20s, 21s who did so well at younger tournaments recently, they're the ones to watch out for when they start getting put into the team. And you see it with Sancho breaking in now, Foden maybe a couple of years' time. There's a good team coming through who are quite well versed in how to play this nice football now. It's very nice to watch and it will achieve things. But at the moment, I don't think England will be able to do. I mean, would you expect them to beat France right now?
Well, I don't know. France lost to Turkey at the weekend, so the world's clearly gone upside down again. I haven't got a clue, frankly. I'd give them a chance. I'd give them a chance, but it's kind of that thing where you're right. You talk about that front three and how strong they are. And I think they are. That's what England need to build on. It's the midfield that's the problem. I could talk about this all day, JJ, but time is running, catching up with us, I'm afraid. Thank you so much for coming on. I always love having you on and talking about the tactical side of football. JJ Bull there, a writer for The Telegraph and also a man who loves tactics, probably more than he loves Scottish football at the moment. They, of course, take on Belgium tonight, which could be quite a tricky game indeed.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. Remember to leave us a rating and a review, but only nice ones. I don't take criticism well.